I am happy to bid you welcome to the 7th lecture under the auspices of the Green Foundation at Westminster College. The John Finley Green Foundation was established at Westminster College in 1937. It was the gift of Mrs. Eleanor Ibbotson Green, a Canadian-born woman deeply devoted to her church and to this college. It is a memorial of her husband, John Finley Green, a distinguished lawyer who was graduated from Westminster College in 1884 and subsequently served upon its board of trustees for 27 years. From his student days, Mr. Green's life exemplified an art which Mrs. Green's gift inspires us to forward, the art of fearless, discerning, and effective public discussion. The foundation provides for lectures from time to time on political and economic matters of international concern. The lecture to be presented from the standpoint of the Christian philosophy. It is a means of stirring up college men's minds and spirits to impatience at lazy thought and slovenly expression, and to the tonic delight of laborious thought and honest, effective expression in a free field. It has become the instrument of extending greatly the service which this college may render the larger community. Today, in this quiet college setting, in the very heart of America, this foundation sponsors a program of significance to the entire world. This occasion cannot but suggest the common heritage of the two great nations represented on this platform this afternoon. And surely it will emphasize the importance to all mankind of the ideals of liberty, cradled in England and nourished as well here as there, while freedom slowly broadens down from precedent to precedent. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with a great deal of happiness that I welcome you to this lecture, the John Finley Green Lecture for 1946. And now I have the honor, ladies and gentlemen, to present the President of the United States.
Crowd of some 2,000 people gathered here in the gymnasium at Fulton at Westminster College are on their feet now, applauding and cheering Mr. Truman as he stands there in a black robe with purple binding and a scholar's hat, the mortarboard, smiling as the photographers take his picture. The audience is still applauding Mr. Truman. He's nodding to them, smiling, and in just a moment he will introduce former Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
President McClure, Governor Donnelly, ladies and gentlemen, you know, this is one of the greatest pleasures and privileges I have had since I have been President of the United States. I appreciate most highly Governor Donnelly's welcome to Mr. Churchill and myself, and I'm very thankful that Dr. McClure suggested to me that Mr. Churchill be invited to deliver this lecture today. I had a letter from Mr. Churchill, 6 months ago or more, in which he said he was considering a vacation in the United States or in North Africa? I sent him Dr. McClure's invitation and made a longhand note on the bottom of it, telling him that if he would spend his vacation in the United States at whatever point he chose to pick, and then would deliver this lecture, I would make it a point to come to Missouri and personally welcome him and introduce him for that lecture. I had never met Mr. Churchill personally until the Berlin conference between Mr. Stalin, Mr. Churchill, and myself. I became very fond of both of them. They are men, and they are leaders in this world today when we need leadership. It's a pleasure to me to introduce Mr. Churchill. He's one of the great men of the age. He's a great Englishman. He's a great Englishman, but he's half American. Mr. Churchill and I believe in freedom of speech. I understand that Mr. Churchill is going to talk on the sinews of peace. I know that he will have something constructive to say to the world in that speech. I am happy that he came here to deliver it, and it's one of the great privileges of my lifetime to be able to present to you that great world citizen, Winston Churchill.
He is clothed in a red robe, a scholastic robe, perhaps an English university. He wore that before he arose to his feet here, a black velvet hat. He turns now and thanks the president. And in just a moment, you will hear Mr. Churchill. Churchill is still standing at the speaker's stand. He has shooed all the photographers away, and he's just now ready to start.
President McClure, ladies and gentlemen, and last, but certainly not least, President of the United States of America, I am very glad indeed to come to Westminster College this afternoon, and I am complimented that you should give me a degree from an institution whose reputation has been so solidly established. The name Westminster somehow or other seems familiar to me. I feel as if I'd heard of it before. Indeed, now that I come to think of it, it was at Westminster that I received a very large part of my education. Politics, dialectic, rhetoric, and one or two other things. So, in fact... we have both been educated at the same or similar, or at any rate kindred, establishments. It is also an honor, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps almost unique, for a private visitor to be introduced to an academic audience by the President of the United States. Amid his heavy burdens, duties, and responsibilities, unsought but not recoiled from, the President has traveled 1,000 miles to dignify and magnify our meeting here today. And to give me an opportunity of addressing this kindred nation, as well as my own countrymen across the ocean, and perhaps some other countries too. The President has told you that it is his wish, as I'm sure it is yours, that I should have full liberty to give my true and faithful counsel in these anxious and baffling times. Now, I shall certainly avail myself of this freedom and feel the more right to do so because any private ambitions I may have cherished in my younger days have been satisfied beyond my wildest dreams. Let me, however, make it clear that I have no official mission or status of any kind. And I speak only for myself. There is nothing here but what you see. I can therefore allow my mind, with the experience of a lifetime, to play over the problems which beset us on the morrow of our absolute victory in arms, and to try to make sure, with what strength I have, that what has been gained with so much sacrifice and suffering shall be preserved for the future glory and safety of mankind. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States stands at this time at the pinnacle of world power. It is a solemn moment for the American democracy. For with primacy in power is also joined an awe-inspiring accountability to the future. If, as you look around you, you must feel not only the sense of duty done, but also you must feel anxiety lest you fall below the level of achievement. Opportunity is here now, clear and shining for both our countries. To reject it or ignore it or fritter it away will bring upon us all the long reproaches of the after time. It is necessary that constancy of mind, persistency of purpose, and the grand simplicity of decision shall rule and guide the conduct of the English-speaking peoples in peace as they did in war. And we must, and I believe we shall, prove ourselves equal to this severe requirement. President McClure, when American military men approach some serious situation, they are wont to write at the head of their directive the words, overall strategic concept. There is wisdom in this, and it leads to clarity of thought. What then is the overall strategic concept which we should inscribe today? It is nothing less than the safety and welfare, the freedom and progress of all the homes and families of all the men and women in all the lands. And here I speak particularly of the myriad cottage or apartment homes, where the wage earner strives amid the accidents and difficulties of life to guard his wife and children from privation and bring the family up in the fear of the Lord, or upon ethical conceptions which often play their potent part. To give security to these countless homes, they must be shielded from the two gaunt marauders, war and tyranny. We all know the frightful disturbance in which the ordinary family is plunged when the curse of war swoops down upon the breadwinner and those for whom he works and contrives. The awful ruin of Europe, with all its vanished glories, and of large parts of Asia, glares us in the eyes. When the designs of wicked men, or the aggressive urge of mighty states, dissolve over large areas the frame of civilized society, humble folk are confronted with difficulties with which they cannot cope. For them all is distorted, all is broken, all is even ground to pulp. When I stand here this quiet afternoon, I shudder to visualize what is actually happening to millions now, and what is going to happen in this period when famine stalks the earth. None can compute what has been called the unestimated sum of human pain. Our supreme task and duty is to guard the homes of the common people from the horrors and miseries of another war. We are all agreed on that. Our American military colleagues, after having proclaimed their overall strategic concept and computed available resources, always proceed to the next step, namely the method. Here again, there is widespread agreement. A world organization has already been erected for the prime purpose of preventing war. You know, UNO, the successor of the League of Nations, with the decisive addition of the United States and all that that means, is already at work. We must make sure that its work is fruitful, that it is a reality and not a sham, that it is a force for action and not merely a frothing of words, that it is a true temple of peace in which the shields of many nations can someday be hung up, and not merely a cockpit in a Tower of Babel. Before we cast away the solid assurances of national armaments for self-preservation, we must be certain that our temple is built not upon shifting sands or quagmires, but upon the rock. Anyone can see, with his eyes open, that our path will be difficult and also long. But if we persevere together, as we did in the two world wars, though not alas in the interval between them, I cannot doubt that we shall achieve our common purpose in the end. I have, however, a definite and practical proposal to make for action. Courts and magistrates may be set up, but they cannot function without sheriffs and constables. The United Nations organization must immediately begin to be equipped with an international armed force. In such a matter, we can only go step by step, but we must begin now. I propose that each of the powers and states should be invited to dedicate a certain number of air squadrons to the service of the World Organization. these squadrons would be trained and prepared in their own countries, but would move around in rotation from one country to another. They would wear the uniform of their own countries, but with different badges. They would not be required to act against their own nation. But in other respects, they would be directed by the world organization. This might be started on a modest scale, and it would grow as confidence grew. I wish to see this done after the First World War, and I devoutly trust that it may be done forthwith. It would nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, be wrong and imprudent to entrust the secret knowledge or experience of the atomic bomb, which the United States, Great Britain, and Canada now share, to the World Organization while it is still in its infancy. It would be criminal madness to cast it adrift in this still agitated and ununited world. No one in any country... No one in any country has slept less well in their beds because this knowledge and the method and the raw material to apply it are at present largely retained in American hands. I do not believe we should all have slept so soundly had the positions been reversed and some communist or neo-fascist state monopolized for the time being these dread agencies. The fear of them alone might easily have been used to enforce totalitarian systems upon the free democratic world with consequences appalling to human imagination. God has willed that this shall not be. And we have at least a breathing space to set our house in order before this peril has to be encountered. And even then, if no effort is spared, we should still possess so formidable a superiority as to impose effective deterrence upon its employment or threat of employment by others. Ultimately, when the essential brotherhood of man is truly embodied and expressed in a world organization with all of the necessary practical safeguards to make it effective, these powers would naturally be confided to that world organization. Now I come to the second of the two marauders, to the second danger which threatens the cottage home and ordinary people, namely tyranny. We cannot be blind to the fact that the liberties enjoyed by individual citizens throughout the United States and throughout the British Empire are not valid in a considerable number of countries, some of which are very powerful. In these states, control is enforced upon the common people by various kinds of all-embracing police governments to a degree which is overwhelming and contrary to every principle of democracy. The power of the state is exercised without restraint, either by dictators or by compact oligarchies operating through a privileged party and a political police. It is not our duty at this time, when difficulties are so numerous, to interfere forcibly in the internal affairs of countries which we have not conquered in war. But we must never cease to proclaim in fearless tones the great principles of freedom and the rights of man, which are the joint inheritance of the English-speaking world, and which through Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, the habeas corpus, trial by jury, the English common law, find their most famous expression in the American Declaration of Independence. All means that the people of any country have the right and should have the power by constitutional action, by free, unfettered elections with secret ballot, to choose or change the character or form of government under which they dwell. That freedom of speech and thought should reign. That courts of justice, independent of the executive, unbiased by any party, should administer laws which have received the broad assent of large majorities or are consecrated by time and custom. Here are the title deeds of freedom which should lie in every cottage home. Here is the message of the British and American peoples to mankind. Let us preach what we practice. Let us practice what we preach. Sir, I have now stated the two great dangers which menace the homes of the people, war and tyranny. I have not yet spoken of poverty and privation, which are in many cases the prevailing anxiety. But if the dangers of war and tyranny are removed, there is no doubt that science and cooperation can bring in the next few years, certainly in the next few decades, to the world, newly taught in the sharpening school of war, an expansion of material well-being beyond anything that has yet occurred in human experience. Now, at this sad and breathless moment, we are plunged in the hunger and distress which are the aftermath of our stupendous struggle. But this will pass, and may pass quickly. And there is no reason, except human folly, or subhuman crime, which should deny to all the nations the inauguration and enjoyment of an age of plenty. I have often used words which I learned 50 years ago from a great Irish-American orator, a friend of mine, Mr. Burke Cochran. There is enough for all. The earth is a generous mother. She will provide in plentiful abundance food for all her children, if they will but cultivate her soil in justice and in peace. And so far, I feel that we are in full agreement. Now, while still pursuing the method of realizing our overall strategic concept, I come to the crux of what I have traveled here to say. Neither the sure prevention of war, nor the continuous rise of world organization will be gained without what I have called the Fraternal Association of the English-Speaking People. This means a special relationship between the British Commonwealth and Empire and the United States of America. Ladies and gentlemen, this is no time for generalities, and I will venture to be precise. Fraternal Association requires not only the growing friendship and mutual understanding between our two vast but kindred systems of society, but the continuance of the intimate relations between our military advisors, leading to common study of potential dangers, to similarity of weapons and manuals of instruction, and to the interchange of officers and cadets at technical colleges. It should carry with it the continuance of the present facilities for mutual security by the joint use of all naval and air force bases in the possession of either country all over the world. Yeah. This would perhaps double the mobility of the American Navy and Air Force. It would greatly expand that of the British Empire forces. And it might well lead, if and as the world calms down, to important financial savings. Already we use together a large number of islands. More may well be entrusted to our joint care in the near future. The United States has already a permanent defense agreement with the Dominion of Canada, which is so devotedly attached to the British Commonwealth and Empire. This agreement is more effective than many of those which have often been made under formal alliances. This principle should be extended to all the British Commonwealths with full reciprocity. Thus, whatever happens, and thus only, shall we be secure ourselves and able to work together for the high and simple causes that are dear to us and bode no ill to any. Eventually, there may come. I feel eventually there will come the principle of common citizenship. But that we may be content to leave to destiny, whose outstretched arm many of us can already clearly see. There is, however, an important question we must ask ourselves. Would a special relationship between the United States and the British Commonwealth be inconsistent with our overriding loyalties to the World Organization? I reply that, on the contrary, it is probably the only means by which that organization will achieve its full stature and strength. There are already the special United States relations with Canada, which I just mentioned. And there are the relations between the United States and the South American republics. We British have also, our 20 years treaty of collaboration and mutual assistance with Soviet Russia. I agree with Mr. Bevin, the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain, that it might well be a 50 years treaty, so far as we are concerned. We aim at nothing but mutual assistance and collaboration with Russia. We have an alliance. The British have an alliance with Portugal, unbroken since the year 1384, and which produced fruitful results at a critical moment in the recent war. None of these clash with the general interest of a world agreement or a world organization. On the contrary, they help it. In my father's house are many mansions. Special associations between members of the United Nations, which have no aggressive point against any other country, which harbor no design incompatible with the Charter of the United Nations, far from being harmful, are beneficial and, as I believe, indispensable. I spoke earlier, ladies and gentlemen, of the Temple of Peace. Workmen from all countries must build that temple. If two of the workmen know each other particularly well and are old friends, if their families are intermingled, if they have faith in each other's purpose, hope in each other's future, and charity towards each other's shortcomings, to quote some good words I read here the other day, why cannot they work together at the common task as friends and partners? Why can they not share their tools and thus increase each other's working powers? Indeed, they must do so, or else the temple may not be built, or being built it may collapse, and we shall all be proved again unteachable and have to go and try to learn again for a third time in a school of war incomparably more rigorous than that from which we have just been released. The Dark Ages may return. The Stone Age may return on the gleaming wings of science. And what might now shower immeasurable material blessings upon mankind may even bring about its total destruction. Beware, I say. Time may be short. Do not let us take the course of allowing events to drift along until it is too late. If there is to be a fraternal association of the kind I have described, with all the extra strength and security which both our countries can derive from it, let us make sure that that great fact is known to the world, and that it plays its part in steadying and stabilizing the foundations of peace. There is the path of wisdom. Prevention is better than cure. A shadow has fallen upon the scenes so lately lighted by the Allied victory. Nobody knows what Soviet Russia and its communist international organization intends to do in the immediate future, or what are the limits, if any, to their expansive and proselytizing tendencies. I have a strong admiration and regard for the valiant Russian people, and for my wartime comrade, Marshal Stalin. There is deep sympathy and goodwill in Britain, and I doubt not here also towards the peoples of all the Russias, and a resolve to persevere through many differences and rebuffs in establishing lasting friendships. We understand the Russian need to be secure on our western frontiers. By the removal of all possibility of German aggression. We welcome Russia to our rightful place among the leading nations of the world. We welcome her flag upon the seas. Above all, we welcome, or should welcome, constant, frequent, and growing contacts between the Russian people and our own peoples on both sides of the Atlantic. It is my duty, however, for I am sure you would not wish me to state the facts as I see them to you. It is my duty to place before you certain facts about the present position in Europe. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow. Police governments are prevailing from Moscow. Yet Athens alone, Greece, with its immortal glories, is free to decide its future at an election under British, American, and French observation. The Russian-dominated Polish government has been encouraged to make enormous and wrongful inroads upon Germany, and mass expulsions of millions of Germans on a scale grievous and undreamed of are now taking place. The communist parties, which were very small in all these eastern states of Europe, have been raised to preeminence and power far beyond their numbers and are seeking everywhere to obtain totalitarian control. Police governments are prevailing in nearly every case, and so far, except in Czechoslovakia, there is no true democracy. Turkey and Persia are both profoundly alarmed and disturbed at the claims which are being made upon them and at the pressure being exerted by the Moscow government. An attempt is being made by the Russians in Berlin to build up a quasi-communist party in their zone of occupied Germany by showing special favors to groups of left-wing German leaders. At the end of the fighting last June, the American and British armies withdrew westward in accordance with an earlier agreement to a depth at some points of 150 miles upon a front of nearly 400 miles in order to allow our Russian allies to occupy this vast expanse of territory which the Western democracies had conquered. If now the Soviet government tries by separate action to build up a pro-communist Germany in their areas, this will cause new serious difficulties in the American and British zones and will give the defeated Germans the power of putting themselves up to auction between the Soviets and the Western democracies. Whatever conclusions may be drawn from these facts, and facts they are, this is certainly not the liberated Europe we fought to build up, nor is it one which contains the essentials of permanent peace. The safety of the world, ladies and gentlemen, requires a new unity in Europe, from which no nation should be permanently outcast. It is from the quarrels of the strong parent races in Europe that the world wars we have witnessed, or which occurred in former times, have sprung. Twice in our own lifetime, we have seen the United States, against their wishes and their traditions, against arguments the force of which it is impossible, the force of which it is impossible not to comprehend. Twice we have seen them drawn by irresistible forces into these wars in time to secure the victory of the good cause, but only after frightful slaughter and devastation have occurred. Twice the United States has had to send several millions of its young men across the Atlantic to find the war. But now war can find any nation, wherever it may dwell, between dusk and dawn. Surely we should work with conscious purpose for a grand pacification of Europe within the structure of the United Nations and in accordance with our charter. That, I feel, opens a course of policy of very great importance. In front of the Iron Curtain, which lies across Europe, are other causes for anxiety. In Italy, the Communist Party is seriously hampered by having to support the communist-trained Marshal Tito's claim to former Italian territory at the head of the Adriatic. Nevertheless, the future of Italy hangs in the balance. Again, one cannot imagine a regenerated Europe without a strong France. All my public life I've worked for a strong France, and I never lost faith in our destiny, even in the darkest hours. I will not lose faith now. However, in a great number of countries, far from the Russian frontiers and throughout the world, communist fifth columns are established and work in complete unity and absolute obedience to the directions they receive from the communist center. Except in the British Commonwealth and in the United States, where communism is in its infancy, the communist parties or fifth columns constitute a growing challenge and peril to Christian civilization. These are somber facts for anyone to have to recite on the morrow of a victory gained by so much splendid comradeship in arms and in the cause of freedom and democracy. But we should be most unwise not to face them squarely while time remains. The outlook is also anxious in the Far East, and especially in Manchuria. The agreement which was made at Yalta, to which I was a party, was extremely favorable to Soviet Russia. But it was made at a time when no one could say that the German war might not extend all through the summer and autumn of 1945, and when the Japanese war was expected, by the best judges, to last for a further 18 months from the end of the German war. In this country, you are all so well informed about the Far East and such devoted friends of China that I do not need to expatiate on the situation there. I have, however, felt bound to portray the shadow which, alike in the West and in the East, falls upon the world. I was a minister at the time of the Versailles Treaty, and a close friend of Mr. Lloyd George, who was the head of the British delegation at that time. I did not myself agree with many things that were done, but I have a very strong impression in my mind of that situation, and I find it painful to contrast it with that which prevails now. In those days, there were high hopes and unbounded confidence that the wars were over and that the League of Nations would become all-powerful. I do not see or feel that same confidence or even the same hopes in the haggard world at the present time. On the other hand, ladies and gentlemen, I repulse the idea that a new war is inevitable, still more that it is imminent. It is because I am sure that our fortunes are still in our hands, in our own hands, and that we hold the power to save the future, that I feel the duty to speak out now that I have the occasion and the opportunity to do so. I do not believe that Soviet Russia desires war. What they desire is the fruits of war and the indefinite expansion of their power and doctrines. But what we have to consider here today, while time remains, is the permanent prevention of war and the establishment of conditions of freedom and democracy as rapidly as possible in all countries. Our difficulties and dangers will not be removed by closing our eyes to them. They will not be removed by mere waiting to see what happens, nor will they be removed by a policy of appeasement. What is needed is a settlement, and the longer this is delayed, the more difficult it will be, and the greater our dangers will become. From what I have seen of our Russian friends and allies during the war, I am convinced that there is nothing they admire so much as strength, and there is nothing for which they have less respect than for weakness, especially military weakness. For that reason, the old doctrine of a balance of power is unsound. We cannot afford, if we can help it, to work on narrow margins, offering temptations to a trial of strength. If the Western democracies stand together in strict adherence to the principles of the United Nations Charter, their influence for furthering those principles will be immense, and no one is likely to molest them. If, however, they become divided or falter in their duty, and if these all-important years are allowed to slip away, then indeed catastrophe may overwhelm us all. Last time, I saw it all coming. And I cried aloud to my own fellow countrymen and to the world. But no one paid any attention. Up till the year 1933, or even 1935, Germany might have been saved from the awful fate which had overtaken her. And we might all have been spared the miseries Hitler let loose upon mankind. There never was a war in history easier to prevent by timely action than the one which had just desolated such great areas of the globe. It could have been prevented, in my belief, without the firing of a single shot. And Germany might be powerful, prosperous, and honored today. But no one would listen. And one by one, we were all sucked into the awful whirlpool. Miss Shirley, ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you, surely we must not let that happen again. This can only be achieved by reaching now, in 1946, this year, 1946, by reaching a good understanding on all points with Russia under the general authority of the United Nations Organization, and by the maintenance of that good understanding through many peaceful years by the world instrument, supported by the whole strength of the English-speaking world and all its connections. There is the solution which I respectfully offer to you in this address, which I have given the title, The Sinews of Peace. Let no man underrate the abiding power of the British Empire and Commonwealth. Because you see that... Because you see the 46 millions in our island harassed about their food supply, of which they only grow one half, even in wartime. Or because we have difficulty in restarting our industries and export trade after 6 years of passionate war effort, do not suppose we shall not come through these dark years of privation as we have come through the glorious years of agony. Do not suppose that half a century from now you will not see 70 or 80 millions of Britons spread about the world, united in defense of our traditions and our way of life and of the world causes which you and we espouse. If the population of the English-speaking Commonwealth be added to that of the United States, with all that such cooperation implies, in the air, on the sea, all over the globe, and in science, and in industry, and in moral force, there will be no quivering, precarious balance of power to offer its temptation to ambition or adventure. On the contrary, there will be an overwhelming assurance of security. If we adhere faithfully to the Charter of the United Nations and walk forward in sedate and sober strength, seeking no one's land or treasure, seeking to lay no arbitrary control upon the thoughts of men. If all British moral and material forces and convictions are joined with your own in fraternal association, the high roads of the future will be clear. Not only for us, but for all. Not only for our time, but for a century to come.